Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. This is Randy Fine. Thank you for tuning in to listen to A Fine Time for Healing. I have a new show opening, but for some reason it didn't start. So sorry about that. It'll just give us more time for our guest today, who is Dr. Vinay Saranga. By now, most people know how real and even disabling a mental health condition can be. Unfortunately, there's still a lot of misguided and incorrect information out there. So what are the real facts about some of the most common mental illnesses? These days, it's tough to be an adult and unable to control your impulses or to remember where you put your keys or to even know whether what you saw was real or hallucination. Today's guest, Dr. Vinay Saranga, MD, is a psychiatrist and founder of Saranga Comprehensive Psychiatry. He says about 450 million people worldwide suffer from a mental health condition like anxiety, depression, or bipolar disorder. Even if you're not one of those people, chances are you have a friend, family member, coworker, or someone else in your life who would benefit from you knowing the facts. And so today, Dr. Saranga is going to give us the facts and explain to us what all the misconceptions are and what the reality is. So I'm anxious to bring him on, and we'll get started. Good morning, Dr. Saranga. Welcome.
Good morning, Randy. How are you? Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. Thank you for being my guest today. You know, as I was telling you, this is a really important show for everybody, but especially for my listeners. So I wanted to kind of go over some of the things that people generally hear. And as I told you, I work with people who have narcissistic abuse issues. And one of the main things that they hear is just get over it. So what do you have to say about that? Because that's very, very painful to hear.
Yes, yes, it certainly can be, because for several reasons. I mean, if you're just telling someone who's really struggling with mental illness, you know, depression, anxiety, it could be any type of mental illness, to just kind of, or even like, for example, ADHD, to just kind of snap out of it or get over it, it can be very painful for that person to hear, because in a sense, it kind of means that you don't really understand what that person is going through. So it kind of diminishes the severity and seriousness of what they're struggling with, and it sometimes can make it seem like you really don't even believe what they're going through, and it can kind of decrease their self-esteem as well. So, and I wish it was easy to say that just you could just kind of get over it or snap out of it when you're struggling with, for example, anxiety or depression. But it's really not that easy. There's a lot of factors that go into why someone may have anxiety or depression. For example, you know, there's biological factors. There could be some genetic factors, you know, family history, if parents have mental illness. So there's some genetic components there as well as, you know, as well as brain development issues and deficits in certain hormone levels in the brain, and also some other psychosocial stressors that I imagine that you're familiar with, Randy, in the work that you're doing with narcissistic abuse. It could be a death of a loved one. It could be marital stress. It could be relationship stress. It could be domestic violence, any kind of trauma, adding to a potential genetic insult, such as the, as I mentioned, a family history of illness. And could be any other kind of social stressors as well. You know, if someone is struggling with, for example, work stress or school stress, that's just kind of adding kind of fuel to the fire. And it's really multiple things that could be going on to as far as why someone may be struggling with anxiety or depression. So that's important for many folks to understand that.
Thank you for that.
Yeah.
Let's maybe I guess we should back up a little bit and talk about what mental illness is, because mental illness exists on a spectrum, a continuum.
Mm-hmm.
There's mild forms, and when people mm-hmm. think of mental illness, they generally think of the most severe, the most obvious. But many
Correct.
Of us have some form of mental illness and just aren't aware that that is the heading that it tends to fall under. So let's talk about what that is.
Yeah, I mean, so if we're speaking about mental illness and more of a broad term, it can be challenging at times, because as you said, there are different severities. So typically, if we're talking about mental illness as disorders, for example, so the definition of a mental disorder would be some type of condition that's causing dysfunction in a person's day-to-day life, at home, at school, at work. So it's interfering with their daily functioning, and that's typically how we define it as a disorder. Now, many folks, we all could potentially get sad or anxious from time to time, and that sometimes can be short-lived, okay? So if you have, for example, a death of a loved one, let's say a death of a sibling or a parent, for example, and you feel, you know, sad for a few weeks, that can be quite normal. But if it's getting to the point where you're even having thoughts of hurting yourself, maybe if you're really not even motivated to, you know, go to work or talk to anyone, and you're significantly isolating yourself for a prolonged period of time, I'm talking about, you know, at least a couple weeks of time, and feeling a lot of guilt, worthlessness, hopelessness, and this is kind of prolonged and continuing on for a long period of time, that's where it can be kind of concerning. But sometimes, you know, if it's a short-lived, you know, let's say, you know, a few days of sadness, or even up to a couple of weeks, but more milder symptoms, you know, it can be a normal reaction to stress, and same goes for anxiety as well. So yeah, as you mentioned, it's different. There's different severities of for example, let's say depression or anxiety, and the milder forms, you know, some folks could get by with just seeing a therapist, for example, or seeing, let's say, a chaplain or some kind of a support person in their life. But the more moderate to severe forms of illness may require a combination of therapy, counseling, and possibly medication, psychiatric medication as well.
Okay, that makes sense. One of the fallacies is that mental illness only occurs in weak people. This is mm-hmm. absolutely not true, right?
Correct. I mean, right. It's certainly not true. So that is a common misconception of it. Really, mental illness can and also there's some going along with that is that there's some folks have the misconception that it may be isolated to certain socioeconomic status, you know, whether it's folks who are maybe low income or higher socioeconomic status, so that's actually completely incorrect. So mental illness can happen to anyone at any time, at any stage of their life, depending on whether you tend to have lower income or even higher income. And it's not, you know, it really doesn't have anything to do with IQ level. Because as I mentioned, part of it is there is a biological brain component where there's different neurotransmitters that are involved, including dopamine. A few would be dopamine, norepinephrine, serotonin, and those levels could be lower in brains of people who have depression or anxiety, and that's part of the reason why it's the theory behind why some of the antidepressant and anti-anxiety medicines work. Is that they increase some of those neurotransmitter levels in the brain, such as serotonin, norepinephrine, and dopamine. Any of us at any stage in our life, you know, can have different stressors that go on. You know, as I mentioned, a death of a loved one. You know, if you or if you're having marital stress or going through a divorce. You know, these kinds of life events and life stressors are can happen to anyone at any time. So, and you know, we've seen, and I'm kind of glad, to be honest, that the celebrities have kind of put their, you know, put their into the limelight their struggles mm-hmm. with depression and anxiety more recently, and that's
like Michael Phelps.
Right. So I mean, and stateside, and I've noticed even in other countries as well. It's great that they're kind of. I think it decreases some of the stigma of it if celebrities and their status are willing to talk about their own struggles, and that kind of normalizes it for folks that may be kind of hiding it because they're worried about the stigma of associated with having depression or anxiety. So, yeah.
Mm, yeah, true. At what point is stress excessive?
So, that kind of goes back again, Randy, to what I was – so if you're feeling – let's say – probably better talk about a specific circumstance. Let's say you have a big test or a big exam coming up. To feel a little bit of anxious butterflies, or let's say an interview, for example, anxious butterflies for, you know, a few days before the test or interview. Maybe have a little bit of trouble sleeping because you're kind of worried about how the test or interview is going to go. You know, you go to the test or interview, you're done with it, and then you're after that piece, that event is done, you kind of go back to your normal life of, you know, sleeping better and not being as worried and things like that. But so that can be a normal reaction to stress. Now, when we talk about folks who, for example, have an anxiety disorder or generalized anxiety disorder, for example, is really folks that are really struggling with worrying excessively all the time about, in that specific disorder, is worrying about constantly about things all the time. It could be work, family, worrying that something bad is going to happen to their children or parents. And it's like a constant excessive worry, and it typically lasts for several, it can last for several months at a time. And so, and folks who, for example, struggling with what's called generalized anxiety disorder, or GAD, you know, they're really having trouble concentrating, focusing, trouble sleeping. They can have a lot of irritability, trouble sitting still, and a lot of muscle tension. And as I mentioned, this is typically going on like every day for several months at a time. And regardless of whether there is an actual stress coming up or not, they're just kind of constantly worried. So that's where I'm talking about, as we were kind of discussing before, is about severities of it. You know, you have a normal reaction to stress and a normal level of anxiety versus it actually being a disorder. For example, what I was discussing with generalized anxiety disorder, where it's really interfering with their daily functioning at home, possibly at work, if they're being irritable with coworkers, family members, that type of thing.
Okay, that definitely makes sense. That helps us to understand that. I wanted to talk about bipolar disorder because I think from where I sit, from the experiences that I have, I believe that bipolar disorder is diagnosed way too frequently and incorrectly quite a lot of times. So, you know, for instance, if somebody is suffering from narcissistic abuse, their emotions can be all over the place because they have had brainwashing. So they don't know who they are at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And so many times they'll come to me and they'll say, I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder and put on medication and it made me worse. So why do you think there's so much misdiagnosis of bipolar?
So, I agree with you. I think that term is kind of, bipolar is kind of being thrown around a lot too without folks necessarily using the specific criteria that's that you would really need to meet to diagnose a specific bipolar disorder. That could be probably a whole hour discussion in itself, is talking about that particular piece. But briefly, okay, a bipolar disorder, if you're talking about the typical forms of, there's two main types of bipolar disorder. There's a type 1 and type 2. Type 1 bipolar disorder is the one that most folks think about the most, is where someone has a full-blown, what's called a manic episode. So, and that can be at least a week of increased self-esteem, high energy, or even irritability, needing less sleep, just someone who's kind of go, go, go for several days at a time. And it's noticeable typically to family and friends. I mean, they're really not sleeping much. They're doing unusual risk-taking behaviors at night, high-risk behaviors, impulsive behaviors at night, maybe calling their friends, you know, in the middle of the night and doing things. So, talking a mile a minute, like you can't even keep up with them. They're talking so fast. So that's kind of the classical bipolar, the type 1, where they have those types of episodes. The type 2 bipolar is it's typically classified as folks who have what's called hypomanic episodes. So it's kind of the manic episode I described before, but a light version of it. So it's typically about 4 days. Or so of kind of milder symptoms of what I was describing. So it was a shorter duration and milder symptoms. And it typically is not causing as much dysfunction in someone's life as the full-blown manic episodes that you see in the type 1 bipolar disorder. Now, those are the two kind of classical bipolar disorders that you'll see described in textbook. This can be complicated because there is an unspecified bipolar disorder as well, and there's also a cyclothymic disorder, which is mild depression alternating with hypomanic types of symptoms, or a little less than hypomanic kinds of symptoms, where someone is not typically, it's not interfering with their daily life as much. So where I think, Randy, you and I are kind of seeing some overlap there as well, is sometimes folks who may have what's called post-traumatic stress disorder or PTSD, when they've, for example, if they've been abused in any way physically through domestic violence, you know, childhood abuse possibly. So sometimes folks who have PTSD can appear to have bipolar or hypomanic or manic symptoms as well, because folks with post-traumatic stress disorder can be very irritable. They can be irritable. They can have trouble sleeping. They can have trouble concentrating. So there's a lot of overlap in those symptoms, and it can be very easily for someone who has been severely traumatized or abused and may actually have post-traumatic stress disorder. It could easily be misdiagnosed as bipolar disorder, because the symptoms are kind of overlapping. So that's where diagnostically it can be a little confusing, and it really needs a trained mental health professional to really help clarify that diagnosis too.
Right. So one really is just based on what's going on with the person, unrelated to any event. The other one is based on an event or events or a circumstance or something like that that's caused trauma.
Correct.
So
correct.
Wouldn't that be the tool, the thing that differentiates them? One is that the person has had trauma?
Correct. I mean, so, yes, I mean, partly. But it would really take a trained person to kind of tease that history out. So getting a good, for a mental health professional, for example, whether it's a therapist or a psychiatrist or a psychologist, getting a good history of those symptoms and when the symptoms started is important as well. And typically, you know, for bipolar disorder, typically the onset is in the late teens. for the first hypomanic or manic episode. And so whereas PTSD could potentially happen at really any stage of life, depending on when the trauma occurred. So, I agree with you there. And it is, to kind of diagnostically as a mental health professional, if we were going to try to clarify that diagnosis, that's kind of where we would look as far as in the history. Was there a big traumatic event that kind of triggered the symptoms for the person? But that being said, it's a little more complicated than that, Randy, because there also can be significant stressors that could cause, for example, a major depressive episode or potentially a manic episode or hypomanic episode as well. So there can be some stressful events that could lead to mood related symptoms like depression or mania as well. So not always the easiest thing to clarify, and that's part of the reason why sometimes getting a good diagnosis is can be a challenge.
Okay, right, yeah, it is. It is hard to, you know, you have to feel comfortable with the person, the doctor that you're with, and everything, but. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it is difficult to, I guess, for you to differentiate that, but that is your expertise. So
Right. And that being said, Randy, and even to make things, you know, even more complicated, is sometimes folks can have post-traumatic stress disorder and major depression, for example. It's called comorbid. So they could have some folks could have the PTSD and severe depression as well, and that is a common occurrence. But fortunately, the medicines that many of the medicines we use to treat PTSD are also the medicines that would help treat depression symptoms. So they're antidepressants as well. So oftentimes we're kind of treating both disorders with the same medications we're using.
That's a good lead into the question I had. I have about medication. I am a proponent of psych medications when they're indicated. You know, I'm not a doctor by any stretch of the imagination, but I do believe there are times where we need a little bit of a help. It doesn't mean that we have to be on them forever, but sometimes it will help us to, you know, the way I describe it is that when you're constantly trying to get just to ground zero, just from up to ground zero, you can never work out your issues because all you're doing is just getting through the days and you're not able to really get anywhere with it. And sometimes medication can relieve that and allow you to work through what you need to work through. What are your feelings?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so medication can be a sticky subject for many folks. And I don't know if we discussed it before, but I'm also a board certified child adolescent psychiatrist as well. So I treat children, teenagers, as well as adults. The reason I'm mentioning that now is because, in addition to adults having a lot of misconceptions and biases about psychiatric medicine, parents have that same. You read something online and about some medication and some horrible things that could happen, or their friends' children had some horrible things that happened to them or side effects from medications, and so those kind of rumors get spread around, and it's unfortunate because then sometimes a child or teenager who would actually benefit from medication don't really get the medication they need, you know. So when we're talking about, as I kind of mentioned previously, is usually milder forms of illness, most mental illness, milder forms, most folks can get by talking to a therapist or counselor to kind of help with some behavior modification, relaxation skill. Let's say behavior mod. So since we're speaking about this more in a broad nature, it's a little more challenging because different diagnoses are treated in different ways. So let's say, since I mentioned I've been child adolescent psychiatrist, let's say ADHD, for example. So if a child has relatively mild forms of a mild form of ADHD. They have a little bit of attention problems, maybe a little bit of trouble sitting still. You know, there are some classroom accommodations that could be made. You know, the teacher could, for example, have them do a lot of tasks or help out in the classroom to keep them busy. Use some kind of organizers or calendars to help them. But now, when we're talking about more moderate to severe symptoms where a child really can't sit still, is being disruptive in class, is failing grades, things like that. And then we need to consider if, for example, ADHD medications could be helpful for them. And they actually can be. They're very effective, actually. They've found to be, in multiple studies, have been ADHD medications have been found to be actually far superior in effectiveness compared to behavior therapy in the trial. So where they did compared children who were just treated with medication versus children who were just treated with behavioral therapy, the group of children that just took medication always fared better and did much better and had much significant improvement in their ADHD symptoms compared to children who only did therapy. So, but that can be kind of an outlier because ADHD is mostly a neurodevelopmental, neurobiological brain development disorder. So medications are very effective for that. So, but I think that kind of general rule kind of applies to, for example, adults who are struggling with depression and anxiety. You know, milder forms of depression and anxiety, you know, most folks would do fine just talking to a therapist or counselor or a chaplain and having that support. But when we're talking about more moderate to severe symptoms where someone is really just not doing much, maybe staying home, missing a lot of work, missing a lot of school, not sleeping much, maybe even an extreme sense of depression is, or severe depression is having suicidal thoughts. You know, these kind of folks would really benefit from a combination of medication and therapy, and the medications can kind of help them get through the hump of that kind of severe symptoms that they're having to at least get them functioning again, get them back to work, get them back to school, get them out of their room, get them out of bed, you know, that kind of thing. And as you mentioned, as far as medications needing to be given for long term, not necessarily. So the recommendations typically is for a patient to be doing well and be stable on medication for at least a year before considering kind of decreasing the dose of medication or stopping it completely. So that's typically the recommendation is to do well on the medication for at least a year before considering backing off on it. But there are risks associated with stopping the medication because if you do decide to stop a medicine after a year, you have a risk of relapse or you have a risk of, for example, the depression or anxiety symptoms coming back. So some folks do decide to stay on the medications long term.
Okay. I think a lot of the misconception about the medication stems from the fact that, well, number one, it's the stigma that they don't think of this as an illness. Number two is that they think they're going to be altered and become a different person, that their personality is going to change. And I know back in the early 80s, when I sought help from a doctor, the only thing they had for depression at that time and anxiety was Valium. That was it. Mm-hmm. That was all they had. And so, so when they would give you Valium, you'd be like, you know, slowed down, and I couldn't function on Valium, so I wouldn't take them. But now the medications, the SSRIs, and there's so many great medications out there that do not cause those kind of feelings, but they take away the feelings or the illness that is impacting your life. So it sort of just removes that and makes life a little easier to live. So what do you have to say about that?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. And that's great that you mentioned SSRI, so you're somewhat familiar with the different medications that are available. So that's great. So we do, to your point, we do have a lot of better medications available now with less severe side effects than some of the older medications we had used. I mean, so for example, we even if we're talking about, and I haven't really delved into this as much, let's say, well, I guess it was for bipolar disorder, so or schizophrenia. So a lot of the medications are kind of similar that we use for bipolar and schizophrenia. So, so we used to have, you know, if you're talking about in the late 1900s. So we were very limited in the medications that were available and the what were called the older or what's called typical antipsychotic medications. So our first generation antipsychotic medications, and they had a lot of side effects. What's called tardive dyskinesia, extrapyramidal symptoms, basically a lot of muscle movement, long-term muscle movement problems that were associated with it. A lot of, for example, tongue movements and facial movements and things like that. So fortunately, we have a lot of newer medications now as far as if we're talking about schizophrenia, for example, what we called second-generation antipsychotics, which could have some of those side effects, but less so, and tend to be better tolerated. So the same goes for antidepressant medications. For example, you mentioned SSRIs or selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, which there are many, and those are actually medicines that are typically used to treat depression and anxiety. And there are many common names that, just to help listeners understand that what we're talking about when you mention SSRIs. Are, for example, fluoxetine or citalopram or sertraline. Those are some medicines that fall into that class, and they're generally pretty well tolerated. And we have even some other kind of newer medications that, for example, duloxetine or bupropion that also are well tolerated and can be very effective. So even for anxiety, these medicines are, for example, the SSRIs are used to treat anxiety as well. And so we do have some more benign medications than for example, the Valium that you mentioned. That Valium is typically associated with some tiredness, and it can be, many folks can sometimes get dependent on it too. So we have medicines that are less, you know, really you don't necessarily get addicted to them, for example, SSRIs, and they have less side effects. So we do have a lot of newer medications that can work well with minimal side effects too. So,
yeah, good. That's true. You know, when you were saying that Valium causes fatigue, the reason that I went to the doctor, I think I was 19 years old, it was a long time ago, and I said, I'm having chronic fatigue, and the doctor said, you're suffering from depression, here's Valium, which to me was the most ridiculous thing because all it did was make me more tired. So so psychiatry has come a very long way since then, I'm really happy to see that. Another thing I wanted to bring up is, when I was doing, I wrote a book called Close Encounters of the Worst Kind, and when I was doing my research for it, what I learned was that there are actual studies that have been done on people who had prolonged childhood abuse, whether it's constant yelling in the house or sexual abuse or whatever it is, prolonged in childhood, that it altered part of the brain, which causes as adults to have some mood regulation issues.
Mm-hmm.
So, am I speaking correctly? And if so, would you explain it?
Well, so I think you're probably referring more to the amygdala. Yeah, there are certain parts of the brain that are more involved in that kind of the fear and trauma response and the hippocampal amygdala areas. That is correct, and so. And really, they've actually the reason behind why we feel that, for example, the SSRIs or selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors work is that we've actually done studies and examined the cerebrospinal fluid of folks who do struggle with depression and anxiety, and we found that their spinal fluid was low in serotonin. So that's why we feel that these medicines, for example, SSRIs, are correcting that deficit, and that's part of the theory for why those medicines help in improving symptoms for folks who have depression and anxiety. So I'm not sure if I'm answered your question correctly.
Well,
I
was talking about, like, so what I read was about the hippocampus, how that the brain gets over flooded with stress hormones. And, you know, I'm talking in layman's terms, and I actually don't have my book in front of me, but
yeah,
that it actually shrinks.
Right.
It's an overflooding of it's a flooding of cortisol that eventually the brain can't deal with, and that eventually it shrinks the size of the hippocampus. That's kind of what I was talking about.
Yeah, that is true, it's been a little while since I've read up on the neurobiological neuroanatomy of it. But yes, that is true, and I do know that high levels of cortisol are related to stress as well. So yeah, so there's a lot. I have seen the brain imaging scans of. When you did your research for the book, your book is that the comparing a person who normally developing brain versus someone, for example, who is struggling from depression or anxiety or trauma, you do see the neuroanatomical changes and change in size of those different areas of the brain, the amygdala, hippocampus. So there are certainly. There are certainly some brain biological changes that happen to the brain from, for example, trauma or high constant stress. And actually, to that point, there's also my training was in the program where I did my residency training was at Wright State University in Ohio, in Dayton, Ohio. And it was a very psychodynamic psychotherapy-oriented program, and a lot of my mentors there, attendings there, were involved in a lot of the studies of psychodynamic psychotherapy, and even showing in their studies of brains of patients who had before starting psychodynamic psychotherapy, starting psychotherapy, and after psychotherapy for, I can't remember the duration now. I imagine it was several months or maybe in several years. I don't remember the duration. But they did even show changes in the brain areas that had been affected by the depression, anxiety, and actually showed improvement in those areas by just psychotherapy and regular therapy itself. I know we spoke a lot about medications before, but I bring that up because I don't want to minimize the importance of therapy, because I was trained in that piece, and I do think that the therapy piece is equally important to the medication for more long-term improvement in symptoms.
Good. I'm glad that you said that. I think that's really important too. I just think that it helps. If it helps my listeners and others to understand that there can be chemical imbalances that may cause them to need chemical corrections, medical, through medication. And so it's not always just a psychological issue. Sometimes there is a physiological issue. So I just kind of wanted to touch on that so that people understand that they may need it. They may not, but they may. And so that's why it's important to be evaluated by a psychiatrist if you think that you're having that issue. Or a psychologist, and then the psychologist can always, send you, if they believe that you need to see a psychiatrist or you need to discuss medication, then they can always send you in that direction. So,
yeah, absolutely.
So tell us about a little bit. So you told us a lot about your practice. Are you, where exactly are you?
So I'm in North Carolina. So I'm in Apex, which is kind of a suburb of the Raleigh. So I'm in the Raleigh-Durham area of North Carolina. So just outside of Cary, pretty much. So it's kind of they call it kind of the Research Triangle over here with Durham, Chapel Hill, and Raleigh. And so yeah, I'm just outside of Raleigh, basically. So I've been a private practice. So I have a private practice here along with my wife, who's a geriatric psychiatrist. So she's specialized in that area, seeing 65 and above, and I'm specialized in child adolescent work. So, and both of us see adults. So we've lived here for several years now, since 2012, and we've enjoyed it here. So it's a great area.
That's great. I know some doctors now are seeing patients through video conferencing, like Skype and Zoom. Do you do that, or do you?
Yes, I do. In my private practice, but also at another location where I work as well. So yes, I do, and I was even trained when I did my child psychiatry fellowship in Kansas City, KU, University of Kansas. So we were also trained in that, and a lot of to where kind of the origins began is of telepsychiatry is it was originally more useful, and I think it is still more useful to reach folks who are living in more rural areas of the country or the state, for example. So it's been a great way to reach, for me and other mental health professionals, to reach patients that really don't have access to mental health care otherwise, just because they may live in some more remote areas where there aren't any probably mental health professionals really. So it's the technology has really improved our ability to reach them and help folks in those areas that really wouldn't have access to mental health care otherwise. And
okay.
It's actually not for someone who's trained in it and has some experience in using it. It's really, I think, for a lot of folks, they probably wouldn't even realize that they were talking to us through the televideo system. So I think it's been technology, and we can do e-prescriptions now, and so it's really changed the way we can practice medicine or psychiatry, for example.
Good. Okay. Do you have a website?
I do. It's sarangapsychiatry.com. I'll spell that S-A-R-A-N as in Nancy, G as in goat, A, psychiatry, psychiatry.com.
Okay. Well, we packed a lot in. That was great. I got all my questions answered. Thank you so much.
Well, I hope it was helpful. I hope it was helpful, Randy. Speaking about mental health, and if you're speaking about it in a general sense, it can be a challenge because it's really each person may be struggling with different illnesses, and the treatments are a little bit different based on that piece. So we'll talk about it in a general sense. It can be a challenge sometimes, but I tried
exactly
to do the best I could.
You did. You did a great job. So thank you for all your wisdom and knowledge. And it's been wonderful having you as my guest today. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on. I enjoyed our conversation.
Good. I have too. Take care. Be well.
Take care. Bye.
Bye. So we are out of time for today, but if you have any comments or questions about today's show, you can email me at loveyourlife@randyfine.com. You may notice I've dropped the G, and I have. So it's just randyfine.com. May joy and serenity always be yours. Goodbye.